If needlework is your passion, whether you're stitching by hand, machine, or mixing it all up, you're going to want to hear about the Mr. X Stitch Contemporary Needlework Prize 2025. This prize celebrates the best in modern stitch and it's open to creatives from all around the world, whether you're a student or an emerging artist or a seasoned professional. And the best part, you don't have to send your work anywhere. Just upload high-resolution images to a private folder we will send you after you enter. You can enter more than one category, for instance, hand embroidery and 3D textiles. Just grab an entry for each one. And if you've got a student ID, you can get 50% off the entry price as well. The deadline for entering is 30th of June 2025, and entries are now open at xstitchmag.com/prize-entry. Thanks to our brilliant sponsors, Bookmarked Hub by Search Press and David and Charles, and the legends at Lowry Workstands. If you've got the stitch bug, this is your time. Show us what you've got. Enter the prize now. Visit xstitchmag.com/prize-entry to get your ticket today. Welcome to Needle Exchange, conversations on the art of thread. This is a bit of a special episode where I'm joined by Neil Twist, who is an academic and self-confessed beginner stitcher based in Melbourne. Neil's just a year into his embroidery journey, but already he's throwing big questions about masculinity, perception, and what it means to stitch as a man. Neil and I were hoping to meet in real life on a recent visit of his to the UK, but unfortunately we couldn't make it happen, so we dived online and we had a good chin wagon at the end of it. I said, do you know what, this sounds like a good needle exchange, so we're going for it. We talk about the courage it takes to embroider in public, the reactions that you get, both expected and surprising, and how those quiet moments with a needle and thread can spark real social reflection. Neil's experience as a gay man brings a rich and thoughtful perspective to the conversation, especially as we compare how our respective identities shape our paths in textile art. If you enjoyed my needle exchanges with John Thomas Paradiso, episodes 11 and 12, where we explored gay identity, intimacy and expression through needlework, I think you'll find a lot to connect with in this chat too. As always, if you're enjoying the show, please leave us a review on your favourite podcasting platform, or maybe just share it with someone who's interested. I'll be back next week with more from Neil, but until then, enjoy the show. What do we start with? What's it like to be a man who stitches? What kind of things do you need? So what was it? What resources do you need? When you said that, I thought just courage. Just courage. That's all you need. Courage and a needle minder, probably.
Look. To be perfectly frank, I think you as a straight man entering the world of needlework has more courage than me as a gay man. And that is interesting in itself, because sometimes I say to people, oh, I've started doing needlework. And they go, well, duh, you're a gay man.
Yeah, right.
Of course you're.
It's an easy pass, isn't it? It's an easy excuse to kind of say that. Do you know what I mean? It's funny.
And I think that was partly what interested me with your experience, is that it is different from mine. Although we're both men, we are, you know, there's difference. And I think that's an interesting gender aspect as well. It is that, you know, it's not the same for all men. And I agree with you. It takes a certain amount of courage to say, yes, I've joined the Embroiderers Guild and, you know, you kind of internally take a sharp intake of breath and think, okay, you know, what's the reaction going to be? And usually the reaction in my very limited experience is,
I'll give you an anecdote, right? So back in the days, I mean, I started cross stitching 2003, started Mr. X Stitch 2008. Around about 2010, 11, 12, 13, I feel like that was like the prime innocent Mr. X Stitch before I was making much of a living about it. But I used to have a job working for children's charity, I used to get the train down to London, and I would also do a monthly cross-stitch workshop at a place called Drink Shop Do, which was in King's Cross. So these were like, to me, they were slightly halcyon days, because it was like, you could see your friends on Twitter, Facebook was nice, Instagram was becoming a thing, we still had Flickr, there was a message board called Craftster, which was also really important to me at the time for finding like-minded people. But what I would do is, because I was relatively carefree, like didn't have any kids or any of that sort of stuff, I would cross-stitch on the train on the way down. And being an English person on a train, A, you don't talk to strangers, B, you don't talk to people who are doing stitching. See, you definitely don't talk to the man who's doing stitching. Do you know what I mean? And I've had people sit in front of me opposite a table looking at every single thing around me because they can't look at me or engage with me because it's too bewildering, right? And that was a lot of a process for me to go through in the first place, sitting there just doing stitching, being at peace with it. I had a certain amount of surety because I was maybe cross-stitching something that it wouldn't have said go fuck yourself, but you know, for me that would be the out, would be going, well, I'm cross-stitching something badass, yeah. So you know, all bets are off completely, yeah. But I remember once getting on the train at Euston Station to get the train home, and I'd got my earbuds in and I was just doing a bit of stitching, and it was just seats, there weren't any tables, but these five guys came down who I think must have been to watch football or something. Five blokes sit down around me and I'm sitting there just doing a bit of stitching. And I was like, how's this going to work or whatever? And at one point, because they weren't drunk, but they were a little bit. And at one point I could tell one of them was looking at me, and then someone said something. Now I've got this fact that I'm 6 foot tall and I'm a bit ugly. So that kind of plays from the old psychology mind game. And what I did was, I also used to do this trick, right? Because the material of jeans is quite thick, so you can put needles into it and it's fine. So sometimes I'd like, if I just change in the needle, I just stick it in my leg because I'm so hard, right? So did that. And then also, like, I was sort of like, sit, and then I just like slowly removed my earbuds and then was like, hello, and just started talking to them. And the thing was, is they asked me what I was doing, and I showed them the pattern that I was doing and stuff like that. And then the guy over sitting across from me was like, my gran does cross stitch. And the thing was, I think that somehow in that moment, something slightly shifted where the two blokes on the far end weren't that interested. They carried on talking. The guy next to me was a bit interested, but the guy opposite me knew what cross stitch was and therefore was kind of interested. And then we got talking about it. And we sort of got talking in very light touches about how not many men do it and all those sorts of things. And I didn't go on the full spiel about it, but by the end, there was this interest because we'd found this like cultural connection where his gran had done it. And it wasn't this totally, totally random thing. It was still a little bit random. But I definitely remember being like, this is going to go fucking weird. Because it was these blokes and the context of them and me not expecting it to go, like me just thinking they'd be hooligans. Whereas in fact, they were humans. And I think somewhere in there, I managed to like make that little connection. And I remember that was probably like one of the most scary public moments, you know?
Yeah.
But I find that for me, it was going through this thing of just, and because as well, it was like early days for like Flickr or Insta or whatever. So it'd be like, hey, look at me, I'm stitching in public, take a photo of myself. Doing a lot of that, I think, helped me just get through it, almost like training runs or something, yeah. So I went through those things. Then, and there's another anecdote of one time I was stitching on a train and the guy, the ticket guy, walks past, does everyone's ticket, sees I'm stitching, carries on going. And then on the way back, hang on, let me see if I can do this off camera. He sort of wandered past and he went, I do rag rugging. And then just like walked all the way through the carriage or something. So he couldn't stop and tell me, but obviously seemed it like there was this space to have a confession or something. So it's kind of weird. It's like, you have to know there's nothing wrong with it, but I think you have to put yourself in those uncomfortable positions so you can find the tale that you have to tell about it or something.
Yeah, but also to just as a man doing needlework plays with assumptions, the assumptions that the man doing needlework might make about other people observing him plays as well, like those five guys. who, you know, or the inspector who, you know, there are closet needle workers everywhere. I think, you know, it's been interesting to, I guess, join the Embroiderers Guild here in, I live in the state of Victoria, so we have states, and the Embroiderers Guild, a friend of mine put me onto very early in the piece, which for me was last year, really, when I decided to do my honours thesis on these needlework samplers. This friend said, get in touch with the Embroiderers Guild. So I did, and I volunteer in their library once a month, and I've gone to a couple of their courses, and it's been a tremendously welcoming and affirming environment of women, largely. I mean, there are a few men who are in the Embroiderers Guild, but none that I've seen at the actual place. But it's been tremendous, and I must say, you know, going to visit Isabella at the Royal School of Needlework, and I went to the Embroiderers Guild UK. That was fantastic as well. And unfortunately, I couldn't get up to Crewe, which would have been
a great thing. I found, because I joined Milton Keynes Embroiderers Guild again, because I thought it was useful to make some in real life connections. And again, like, and the problem is I have little stories about this stuff because I've said this thing over and over again. But like, I used to work in quite a rough pub, and sometimes there'd be fights and stuff. Not very often or whatever, but I can remember being more nervous the first time I went to the Embroiderers Guild, because you know that you're stepping into this territory, aren't you? And the thing is they don't know. They don't know if you're going to rock up and be cynical or whatever, because you're such an anomaly. 2 weeks in, 2 weeks down the road, when I've been back a couple of times and they know that I'm for real, or 2 months or whatever, then, yeah, like you say, really supportive environment. I really liked it because I learned about stuff I would never think to go and look for. Like, we did a session on flower pounding, where you hit flowers onto fabric and it transfers the dye. Like, no, in my mind, I would never consider doing that. So it was useful from that standpoint. And again, useful to just get over it, and useful to try and get around the story. But like, when I was at uni, I did a degree in psychosocial studies, which is like, the strapline was like, man's influence on society and society's influence on man. And at the time, it was a pretty cushy degree course, did stuff on advertising and bits of counseling, this and that and the other. It's bonkers how strong, by going, I'm a guy and I do needlework, how many stories of society suddenly you're tied into. Because as you said, it's not just it's needlework as an art form, needlework is done by little old ladies, like masculinity, craftsmanship, all these kind of stories that we're told, even just the how we talk to people on a train in England stories, you know, they're all there and you're just bouncing in amongst all of them. Like is it like the Truman Show or something, or like where you suddenly, you just hit a wall, or like if you're a vampire and you're not allowed to enter a building or something, and suddenly you hit a barrier and you're like, what's this invisible barrier I seem to see? It's really weird.
It is. And I remember the first day I went to the Embroiderers Guild, and it was to, it was basically to, this friend had given me an introduction to one of the women who it was really about an in to make my honours thesis more easy, for want of a better term. But I must admit, it felt to me, I thought, I don't want to come in here and just use the, you know, just pick these people's brains for my thesis, as generous as they are with their time. It made me think about, well, what am I doing here, and is there anything of value that I can contribute to what they do, given that the Embroiderers Guild is providing me with help and information about my thesis, and might I say, very generous with their time and knowledge. So that was where the volunteering started, because I got, you know, you get the newsletters and stuff that organisations send you, and the Embroiderers Guild put out a call for people to work in the library. So I thought, right, you know, that's a way I can contribute back. And that has led to a whole conversation that I have with the Cruel Group, because my day of volunteering is the Cruel kind of network day, which is a fascinating thing. So it's a fascinating thing about when you break through a barrier, how you think about, well, it wasn't really a barrier at all, other than in my own mind. You know, I had never thought about needlework until, you know, I was casting around for things that I might write about for this thesis.
Yeah.
And it was pretty pragmatic, I'd have to say. I was thinking about, well, I need something that is fairly fairly attainable. So mm-hmm. the university art collection was a start. And we have in the university art collection, this family, the Grimwades, basically donated their house and all of its contents to the university. So the university has this big archive of this family's stuff. And I was looking online through all of the stuff, and they were great collectors of 19th century Australian landscapes, and also ceramics. And so in amongst all this flicking through, there were these needlework samplers that were an oddity to me in this collection. And I thought, that's interesting. So that was one part of it. And then I started thinking about and reflecting back on my arts degree and the art history subjects, and how, other than sort of in passing, there wasn't the textile arts and things like needlework didn't get a big showing. And that's not a criticism of the university or the course. It was a fantastic course, but I thought, well, maybe there's a gap here that I could, in a small way, help to fill. So that that got me very interested. And so then I tested it out on some of the academics at university, and they seemed interested as well. So in some ways, my interest in needlework is very pragmatic, in that I needed a subject that I thought, well, the whole idea of university research is it's meant to add knowledge. And I thought, there are so many well-traversed areas in art history that aren't going to add a lot of knowledge. But then I thought, well, needlework, well, I haven't learned a lot about it in the course of doing my degree. Maybe other people haven't as well. So that was what got me started. And then I started casting around for resources. And that was when I hit upon your podcast, Isabella's podcast. And I thought, oh, there is a world here. There is a big world here. And I want to be a part of it. So that's kind of...
Can I ask some ignorant questions? Right. So Australian history, from that standpoint, if we exclude Indigenous art, what's the kind of timescale? For instance, I don't know off the top of my head when Australian settlers first arrived. So what kind of time frame are we talking?
So Cook first started, first stepped on soil in 1770. And then in 1778, the invasion really occurred. And when I grew up going to school, I was taught that it was a discovery, that this was the discovery. It's not. Land was invaded, and there were, if you look at a map of the First Nations of Australia, there were hundreds of nations here before the British arrived, who had been up north, had been trading with the Macassans. There was a big trade with the Macassans. The Portuguese and Dutch had visited. Anyway, 1788 is when it really kicks off. That's when all of the convicts started arriving. And so in terms of the thousands of years of history of this land, it's a moment that we're talking about, that non-Aboriginal people have been here.
Yeah, because I'm interested, it's kind of like the same with America. Like, I've got this this idea in my head just about the length of history and the amount of time certain crafts have in history. Like American quilts and those kind of things are very much a part of American history, because in some ways American, if we stand at the British standpoint, right, American history from white people like that is relatively short. And so it's interesting that some of these crafts have had a very full history in that context. And I wonder what crafts go in Australian. And because you said like needlework sampan has seemed like an anomaly, you wonder whether needlework and textile art forms a part of that entire 250 year swathe of, you know, history.
It does, and indeed Aboriginal people were engaged certainly in weaving for thousands of years. So the state that I'm from, Victoria, was originally a group of nations that, because we're south and cooler, there were farms in what we now call Victoria, and there were very ingenious systems of eel traps. They would make these woven, beautiful pieces that modern art now, Aboriginal art, there are eel trap works in galleries, but they served a very practical purpose of trapping eels that people would then use for food. Up north, again, in the trade with Macassans, the Yolngu people would do tons of weaving, both decorative and for a very practical purpose. So, you know, just as needlework and tapestry and textile arts have been around for thousands of years everywhere, the same here. In terms of needlework and what we look at today in terms of samplers, the earliest kind of Australian samplers are probably, you know, early 1800s. Like, it didn't take long for that English tradition to come over here, or British tradition to come over here. And certainly once people started having children over here, you know, kids start doing that kind of stuff. Often, though, in not very happy circumstances. Orphanages were quite common in right. the early years, and they were where the children of convicts went. There was one, I was having a chat, Isabella was, she had a sampler from one of the Tasmanian orphanages that she was asking me about. And I did a little bit of research on it because I thought, well, why, you know, we think of orphanages as places for children whose parents have died. Here, they were places for children of prisoners often. Or there was a very kind of sanctimonious and moralistic view of what a good parent was, and if you were deemed a bad parent, which probably meant you fell foul of the authorities in some way, your child was taken away from you. So the art of needlework in some respects has a very sad history here.
Yeah, because I guess the children of prisoners aren't prisoners, are they? Just because their parents are. I was, when I worked for a children's charity, there was a neonatal unit that was inside a women's prison. And it was just this funny bit of non-prison that was inside the prison, because that was where the babies were, but they weren't prisoners. It was a funny anomaly. So I guess in that case, you're saying they were just shipped out to orphanages, and if their parents came out of prison, then maybe they could be reconnected.
Yeah, yeah. Although I suspect not, but and you know, when you look at what people were in prison for, and how they ended up in Australia, I mean, it was a class thing. Poor people came to Australia. And even when they arrived, I mean, the place was a tyranny when it began. It wasn't government as we know government today. It's not I think I'm not sure where this point is taking me, but than to say, I think it's interesting to look at how recent that history is, you know.
But also, you know, in the way that samplers were used as a way of handing down generational education, right? Samplers were used as a way of teaching people morality without them realizing, from what I gather. You know, you stitch these phrases that teach you how to be a better person. If you're lucky, you can have a little bit of a reflection of yourself in it. It's interesting that even in those kind of circumstances where it's almost like it's an industrial settlement, it's not about people living a good life, it's about just getting people out of our country, stick them over there, yeah, and paraphrasing. But it's interesting then that those tools remain, like in particular that form of education, teaching needlework skills, teaching people certain moral and social codes through that mode. It's interesting that kind of eked its way through. And I mean, have you got a theory about samplers? Where's your thesis at the moment, sort of?
It hasn't yet begun.
Right.
So I'll commence the honours thesis in July. Where I started and where I still am at the moment is that, okay, there are these two samplers. One is a map and one is, well, it's not a sampler. It's a pictorial needlework. I don't know why I'm doing the shape of
That's fine. Yeah,
the pictorial, it's a castle. So where I started was looking at the provenance of these two pieces. And we have a provenance letter at the university in relation to one of them, which was that it was done by Beatrice Acton, who was allegedly a niece of a Baronet Acton in Shropshire. And not a lot else. The university or the Rather, the attribution is that both of these works are by the same girl or young woman. I think she was about 14 when the map is easier because it's got her initials, BA, and it's got the year. Right. So that's kind of, I think, how that link has been made. The castle has no identifying features at all. And one possibility is that they were both just put together and thought of as being by the same person. But speaking to Isabella, who I had sent both of them to, I'm starting to think they're not. So really, this is as much a provenance question as it is a needlework question in terms of where my thesis is going. But they are interesting works in terms of needlework. The map, because maps were such a big focus of British samplers, and they are late 18th century. The map is 1794. The castle's not dated. Isabella's view was that the castle, if it was done by the same person, was done much later, because the stitching is very accomplished. It's a very different, as I say, it's not a sampler. So it's not like something that was done by a schoolgirl. It's a different kettle of fish. So that work is becoming much more interesting to me because it's much more of a mystery. So that's where that's at.
Do your embroiderers guild colleagues, are they sampler? Because the thing is, over here, like, people just don't do samplers. You know, there needs to be a sampler renaissance. It would be nice if the curriculum would afford people the space to do it, because you might not put all the dogma in, but you could still teach some people some nice skills. They could make a thing that means something. That's the sort of cute version of it. But I just wonder whether you've got people or you've met people of a generation where samplers were still a thing, and what they have to say about it.
Yeah, I haven't yet. I haven't yet gone to that depth in terms of talking to people at the guild. At the moment, I guess I'm kind of moving slowly and seeing this as a, as they say, a marathon, not a sprint, in the sense that, I don't want to go there and just pick people's brains all the time. But I've just done an article for the magazine that the Embroiderers Guild puts out, talking about my trip to the UK and talking about these samplers and saying to people, look, if you know anything about this stuff, get in touch with me. So I'm hoping that will yield some things. My guess is that, yes, a number of the people in the guild would have done samplers, but they are so experienced that that was a long time ago. But also, I'd have to say, I don't know when the making of samplers stopped being a thing here, and how much of the work that people are doing now at the Embroiderers Guild stemmed from doing samplers as opposed to doing other things.
I mean, I guess, like, did you get to talk to Angie in, like, the degree side of the RSN much?
No.
Okay.
No.
Go on. No, I was going to say that because they've got the hand embroidery degree, haven't they? And so to an extent, by the end of the first year, they've all done effectively a sampler. And it's not all the alphabets and all the cutesy things that most people think of samplers, but it's very much a sample of stitches. I was doing this thing last week, the Stitch Festival in Islington. So I had a stand, we had cross stitches from the magazine on the walls, and we were teaching people cross stitch. And I had degree students from the RSN who were there. And it was really nice because they each year group works really hard and they have to put in the hours to learn to do the stitching as well as understanding the context and thinking about their own creative process and all that kind of stuff. But we had year students from different year groups and they don't mingle very much circumstantially, but it was quite nice because one day we had two second year students and we had a first year student, and the first year student was looking, they'd been shown the samplers that the second years had done as a finished product, and they're looking at those things in awe, just being like, oh my god, look at the quality of the stitching. And the two second years are looking back at the thing that they did at the end of the first year being like, oh god, that's a bit rubbish. And it's just a really fun perspective to kind of explore, you know, because you don't see the distance traveled unless you see someone that's further back down the path. And I just thought it's really nice to be able to make those guys get that perspective, to have third years talking with first years, because the third years are now producing their own creative output, whether it's fashion embroidery or artistic stuff, and yet the first years are at the start of that journey and what kind of inkling feelings they're getting. And I was always trying to pry that out of people, you know, do what, it's early days in your first year at the degree course, but you know, do you have a particular yearning in a particular direction? Because by the end, they all start off going, this is crewel work, these are French knots, these are like, I don't know, this is couching, whatever. And by the third year, they're in 15 different directions with their own creative process, which is kind of wonderful to see. But they're doing a hand embroidery degree, and I would be surprised if any one of them had done anything resembling a sampler in the lead up to that. They might have done textile design, surface design, a bit of sewing, something like that. But none of the samplers like they used to do. It's just not a thing anymore. Thanks for joining me on another Needle Exchange. I hope you enjoyed the show. I'd love to hear from you, so feel free to email hello@needle.exchange, that's NEEDL.exchange, with any thoughts, comments or feedback. And if you want to keep up with all the news, sign up to the Needle Exchange mailing list at bit.ly/needleexchange. See you next time.